Good evening. We are working still in the second chapter in the second book of the Life Divine. And we're in the last portion of it, so Sri Aurobindo is beginning to assemble the various elements that are in the title of this chapter: Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. When we left the last passage, Sri Aurobindo had been discussing the self and the nature of its eternal freedom, its impersonality, and he had just mentioned above in that paragraph that the Chit Shakti is the conscious power of this self. And now we continue with that idea, but we enter a new phase of the discussion with this. The conscious being, Purusha, is the self as originator, witness, support, and Lord and enjoyer of the forms and works of nature. So he's identified these various terms applied to the nature of being. Sat is, according to our understanding and experience of it, conscious of itself. It is chit. It is also core to the nature of the personhood, he says. So conscious being, chit, is the same thing as the self, and the self is that which constitutes the reality of the Purusha. And that Purusha is not simply, as he suggests in this sentence, a mere witness, but is the originator as well. He's the witness, but also the support, the Lord, the enjoyer of the forms and the works of nature, which are cast out by the infinity of the creative genius of the Chit Shakti. So now he will bore in and focus on this idea of the Purusha. As the aspect of self is in its essential character transcendental, even when involved and identified with its universal and individual becomings, so the Purusha aspect is characteristically universal individual and intimately connected with nature, even when separated from her. So just as the self is all poises at once, it is transcendence in its own white solitude, it is universal in expanse, because all the universe, in a sense, floats in an aspect of its being, and it stands at the center of any individual reality as well. So, too, stands this Purusha, but characteristically as a universalized, individualized aspect of this same being. He continues, for this conscious spirit, while retaining its impersonality and eternity, its universality, puts on at the same time a more personal aspect. And there's a footnote here. The Sankhya philosophy stresses this personal aspect, makes the Purusha many, plural, and assigns universality to nature. In this view, each soul is an independent existence, although all souls experience a common universal nature. Now, this is the classical Sankhya view that we know from the Sankhya Karikas, which roughly composed, let's say, 300, 400 CE. And while each Purusha is separate from each other Purusha, each Purusha looks only at one common nature in this system. And that is what Sri Aurobindo is trying to encapsulate here. Whether or not that is the original vision that the sage Kapila had when he, in a sense, founded this school on this insight that the soul can always stand back from nature and retire into its witness gaze and be free from the turbulence of the manifest nature, is another question. Kapila is obviously many centuries older than this and was so well regarded that the heritage following his incarnation on earth named the city, the state, after him, Kapilavastu. So he was a great sage, one of the greatest, and apparently non-Vedic. He isn't mentioned in the Veda. He is a separate, freestanding figure from outside the Vedic corpus.
Mentioned in the Gita.
The experience, let me see. It is the impersonal, personal being in nature from whom it is not altogether detached, for it is always coupled with her. Nature acts for the Purusha and by its sanction, for its will and pleasure. The conscious being imparts its consciousness to the energy we call nature, receives in that consciousness her workings as in a mirror, accepts the forms which she, the executive cosmic force, creates and imposes on it, gives or withdraws its sanction from her movements. So we see this larger picture. There is a divine being who wears all these poises of being as garments, whether we're talking about transcendence, universality, or individuality. Nature may seem to stand apart from Purusha, but always nature impliedly is acting for the delight of the Purusha. Sri Aurobindo will bring this together and show that there is no division between consciousness and nature, that ultimately they are one, they are in constant relationship. To continue, he writes, the experience of Purusha Prakriti, the spirit or conscious being in its relations to nature, is of immense pragmatic importance. For on these relations, the whole play of the consciousness depends in the embodied being. So how soul relates to nature, not just to body, but to life, to mind, to every aspect of nature, is critically important, and that there is a constant, profound relationship is an important insight offered in this Sankhya philosophy. Even if it's not brought to the fore, as Sri Aurobindo does here, it's an important insight that is there embedded. If the Purusha in us is passive and allows nature to act, accepting all she imposes on him, giving a constant automatic sanction, then the soul in mind, life, body, the mental, vital, physical being in us becomes subject to our nature, ruled by its formation, driven by its activities. That is the normal state of our ignorance. So if Purusha does not exert itself, but simply watches and, in a sense, by watching sanctions the play of Purusha, then Purusha becomes bound to the actions as it stations itself at the various levels of its personhood, mind, life, body, etc. He continues now, if the Purusha in us becomes aware of itself as the witness and stands back from nature, that is the first step to the soul's freedom. If you become the witness, the sakshi, simply observing, you become detached. For it becomes detached, he says, and it is possible then to know nature and her processes and in all independence, since we are no longer involved in her works, to accept or not to accept, to make the sanction no longer automatic, but free and effective. We can choose what she shall do or not do in us, or we can stand back altogether from her works and withdraw into the self's spiritual silence. Or we can reject her present formations and rise to a spiritual level of existence, and from there recreate our existence. The Purusha can cease to be subject, Anisha, and become lord of its nature, Ishvara. And that suggests yet another transition. So, Sri Aurobindo makes it clear that if we do step back in this first liberation from enthrallment to nature and discover in the gulfs of our own being our spiritual freedom and can stand and look at it, then we can decide to involve ourselves or not to involve ourselves, to accept the dance that nature offers or not to accept, to insist that the dance change its choreography. Or we can even, from that station of inward silence and witness aloofness, rise to a higher state of consciousness and recreate our existence, impliedly recreate nature's play as well as the height of the spirit's view. So again, consciousness and play of consciousness in nature, united, because first we step inside and become free and then rise to a higher station. By doing that, we become no longer subject to the play of nature, but we become master of it. We move from the Anisha to the Isha state, lord of the nature, Ishvara. He continues at the next paragraph. In the philosophy of the Sankhyas, we find developed most thoroughly the metaphysical idea of Purusha Prakriti. These two are eternally separate entities, but in relation to each other. Prakriti is nature power and executive power. It is energy apart from consciousness. For consciousness belongs to the Purusha. Prakriti without Purusha is inert, mechanical, inconscient. Now remember, he's not describing the ultimate look at Purusha Prakriti here. He's describing what the Sankhya philosophy presents to us. Prakriti develops as its formal self and basis of action primal matter, and in it manifests life and sense and mind and intelligence. But intelligence too, since it is part of nature and its product in primal matter, is also inert, mechanical, and conscient, a conception which sheds a certain light on the order and perfectly related workings of the inconscient in the material universe. It is the light of the soul, the spirit, that is imparted to the mechanical workings of sense, mind, and intelligence. They become conscious by its consciousness, even as they become active only by the assent of the spirit. So even here, impliedly, the connection that stirs Prakriti to move, to work, is the gaze of the consciousness, which here is owned by Purusha. But Purusha is always in relationship with Prakriti. So its gaze is the light of the soul, which imparts motion to Prakriti even in its inconscient basis, in brute, crude matter. The Purusha, he writes, becomes free by drawing back from Prakriti. It becomes master of her by refusing to be involved in matter. Nature acts by three principles, modes or qualities of its stuff and its action, which in us become the fundamental modes of our psychological and physical substance and its workings, the principle of inertia, the principle of kinesis, and the principle of balance, light, and harmony. In other words, these are the three gunas. This is tamas, rajas, and sattva. When these are in unequal motion, her action takes place. When they fall into equilibrium, she passes into quiescence. And this is quiescence occurring only when Purusha withdraws its gaze from Prakriti. When Purusha watches Prakriti, Prakriti stirs and begins her motion. He continues, Purusha, conscious being, is plural, not one and single, while nature is one. It would seem to follow that whatever principle of oneness we find in existence belongs to nature. But each soul is independent and unique, soul to itself and separate, whether in its enjoyment of nature or its liberation from nature. All these positions of the Sankhya we find to be perfectly valid in experience when we come into direct inner contact with the realities of individual soul and universal nature. But they are pragmatic truths, and we are not bound to accept them as the whole or the fundamental truth either of self or of nature. So as we commonly experience nature, we find it to be one in presentation to us. Everybody looks at the same nature. We agree about that. But we can't, in a sense, have that same experience of oneness looking at each other. We don't have the intersubjectivity to become aware of another person's consciousness. So we conclude that each person is a separate soul with a consciousness all its own. And Sri Aurobindo says, yes, this is a beginning truth. Let's start with that. But as he says, it's a pragmatic truth, and it's not the whole or fundamental truth. It's not the whole truth of self. It's not the whole truth of nature either. He continues, Prakriti presents itself as an inconscient energy in the material world, but as the scale of consciousness rises, she reveals herself more and more as a conscious force, and we perceive that even her inconscience concealed a secret consciousness. So too, conscious being is many in its individual souls, but in itself, we can experience it as one in all and one in its own essential existence. So the oneness of nature. We can exceed this first vision of consciousness awakened to its own self. Moreover, the experience of soul and nature as dual is true, but the experience of their unity has also its validity. If nature or being is able to impose its forms and workings on being, it can only be because it is nature or energy of being, and so the being can accept them as its own. If the being can become Lord of nature, it must be because it is its own nature which it had passively watched doing its work, but can control and master. Even in its passivity, its consent is necessary to the action of Prakriti, and this relation shows sufficiently that the two are not alien to each other. So there is a profound connection between Purusha and Prakriti. They are not separate. The duality, he says, is a position taken up, a double status accepted for the operations of the self-manifestation of the being, But there is no eternal and fundamental separateness and dualism of being and its consciousness force, of the soul and nature. So dualism is integrated into a larger oneness. And if it seems to have a play that lends reality to this idea of dualism, it is because it is for the operations of nature at its starting point that this is so. Sri Aurobindo, by implication, suggests that the evolution of nature's laws, the evolution of consciousness in nature, will arrive at a convergence, again, of consciousness and being in nature. They will be one in play. They may seem to be separate and many. We will wind up in a diversified oneness at the end of the play of nature. It is the reality, the self, that takes the position of the conscious being regarding and accepting or ruling the works of its own nature. An apparent duality is created in order that there may be a free action of nature working itself out with the support of the Spirit, and again, a free and masterful action of the Spirit controlling and working out nature. This duality is also necessary, that the Spirit may be at any time at liberty to draw back from any formation of its nature and dissolve all formation, or accept or enforce a new or a higher formation. Put simply, Purusha and Prakriti are willed expressions of the Supreme Reality. And it's necessary to the play, it's necessary to the freedom and the rearrangement of the developing cosmos that this seeming separation between Purusha and Prakriti exists. This duality is also necessary that the Spirit may be at any time at liberty to draw back from any formation of its nature and dissolve all formation or accept or enforce a new or a higher formation. See? These are very evident possibilities of the Spirit in its dealings with its own force, and they can be observed and verified in our own experience. They are logical results of the powers of the infinite consciousness, powers which we have seen to be native to its infinity. This point that we can observe and verify it in our own nature is again the touchstone of truth to Sri Aurobindo. It is not enough to philosophize, to arrive at a rational order which seems to reflect as a simulacrum the truth of what we experience in nature. It must resound in our own personal experience. We must know it to the core of our being to be true. It must be true to our spiritual experience, to our realization. The Purusha aspect and the Prakriti aspect go always together. And whatever status nature or consciousness force in action assumes, manifests, or develops, there is a corresponding status of the Spirit. So Purusha and Prakriti are always paired in the play of nature. And now he describes just how far that goes. In its supreme status, the Spirit is the supreme conscious being, Purushottama, and the consciousness force is his supreme nature, Paraprakriti. Yes, this goes back to the Gita, Purushottama, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, verse 18, Paraprakriti, Paraprakriti, chapter 7, verse 5. In each status of the gradations of nature, the Spirit takes a poise of its being proper to that gradation. In mind nature, it becomes the mental being. In life nature, it becomes the vital being. In nature of matter, it becomes the physical being. In supermind, it becomes the being of knowledge. In the supreme spiritual status, it becomes the being of bliss and pure existence. In us, in the embodied individual, it stands behind all as the psychic entity, the inner self, supporting the other formulations of our consciousness and spiritual existence. The Purusha, individual in us, is cosmic in the cosmos, transcendent in the transcendence. The identity with the self is apparent, but it is the self in its pure, impersonal, personal status of a spirit in things and beings. Impersonal because undifferentiated by personal quality. Personal because it presides over the individualizations of self in each individual, which deals with the works of its consciousness force, its executive force of self-nature, in whatever poise is necessary for that purpose. So we can see that the way personhood relates to nature at each stage becomes not only the participant, but also the support. So at the level of matter, it is the Anamaya Purusha, the Purusha who's supporting the realm of food. At the level of the life force, he is Pranamaya Purusha, that person who supports and extends himself as the vital personality, the being of life. At the level of mind is Manomaya Purusha, the mental person sustaining that realm of light and clarity. But above, he becomes Vijnanamaya Purusha, the great consciousness, Mahas, the supramental being. And above that, the bliss self, Anandamaya. Anandamaya. But within all, this being is there. Behind, you might say, that being who supports mind, life, body, is that essence of our soul, the psychic essence. And there also speaks of that supreme Purusha. The Gita also speaks about being stationed, established in the center of all beings. That is the truth that is the living essence of every individual expression. All are persons of that person. All are aspects and portions of that great being. Mind, life, body. Personhood establishes them solidly, but most at the level and the essence of our soul. Sri Aurobindo then begins a new paragraph in which he will take up the final step of being. If he's talked about Atman, the self, and he's talked about Purusha, the person, now he will talk about the Lord and Master of all, the Ishvara. But it is evident that whatever the posture taken or relation formed in any individual notice of Purusha Prakriti, the being is in a fundamental cosmic relation, Lord or ruler of its nature. For even when it allows nature to have its own way with it, its consent is necessary to support her workings. This comes out in its fullest revelation in the third aspect of the reality, the divine being who is the master and creator of the universe. Here, the supreme person, the being in its transcendental and cosmic consciousness and force, comes to the front, omnipotent, omniscient, the controller of all energies, the conscious in all that is conscient or inconscient, the inhabitant of all souls and minds and hearts and bodies, the ruler or overruler of all works, the enjoyer of all delight, the creator who has built all things in his own being, the all-person of whom all beings are personalities, the power from whom are all powers, the self, the spirit in all, by his being, the father of all that is, in his consciousness force, the divine mother, the friend of all creatures, the all-blissful and all-beautiful, of whom beauty and joy are the revelation, the all-beloved and all-lover. In a certain sense, so seen and understood, this becomes the most comprehensive of the aspects of the reality, since here all are united in a single formulation, for the Ishvara is supracosmic as well as intracosmic. He is that which exceeds and inhabits and supports all individuality. He is the supreme and universal Brahman, the absolute, the supreme self, the supreme Purusha. But very clearly, this is not the personal God of popular religions, a being limited by his qualities, individual and separate from all others. For all such personal gods are only limited representations or names and divine personalities of the one Ishvara. Neither is this the Saguna Brahman, active and possessed of qualities, for that is only one side of the being of the Ishvara. The Nirguna, immobile and without qualities, is another aspect of his existence. Ishvara is Brahman, the reality, self, spirit, revealed as possessor, enjoyer of his own existence, creator of the universe and one with it, pantheos, and yet superior to it, the eternal, the infinite, the ineffable, the divine transcendence. So this is the consummate being, the Ishvara, the master, who is all-inclusive, who is the positive impersonality, the negative impersonality, who constitutes nature, who constitutes all awakenings within nature, who is the God that all seek, and yet is beyond the definition and the formulation of all gods that we know, because all are limited. If we think God is all good and stands transcendent to the universe, this is not that God, because this Godhead dwells in the universe, has become all things, even the darkness that we experience, even the things that are antagonistic to our sense of goodness and tranquility and beauty. All those things, too, are within his immensitude. So he exceeds the scope of all things, and yet drives all things towards an ultimate expression of truth that is true to their nature as expressions of his being. Pantheos, God is all, God in all, God of all, God as all. The sharp opposition made between personality and impersonality by our mental way of thinking is a creation of the mind based on the appearances of the material world. For here, in terrestrial existence, the inconscient from which everything takes its origin appears as something entirely impersonal. Nature, the inconscient energy, is entirely impersonal in her manifest essence and dealings. All forces wear this mask of impersonality, all qualities and powers, love and delight and consciousness itself have this aspect. Personality makes its apparition as a creation of consciousness in an impersonal world. It is a limitation by a restricted formation of powers, qualities, habitual forces of the nature action, an imprisonment in a limited circle of self-experience which we have to transcend. To lose personality is necessary if we are to gain universality, still more necessary if we are to rise into the transcendence. So here he speaks as if all this idea of personhood has to be left behind us. We must transcend it. Personality arises in an impersonal world because it's its first outing. It's a restriction of force and awareness into a limited mold so that it can define itself, can create itself. And obviously the ego is its first signature. Is it its last? But what we thus call personality is only a formation of superficial consciousness. Behind it is the person who takes on various personalities, but is himself one, real, eternal. If we look at things from a larger point of view, we might say that what is impersonal is only a power of the person. Existence itself has no meaning without an existent. Consciousness has no standing place if there is none who is conscious. Delight is useless and invalid without an enjoyer. Love can have no foundation or fulfillment if there is no lover. All power must be osios if there is not an almighty. For what we mean by person is conscious being. Even if this emerges here as a term or product of the inconscient, it is not that in reality, for it is the inconscient itself that is a term of the secret consciousness. What emerges is greater than that in which it emerges, as mind is greater than matter, soul than mind. Spirit, most secret of all, the supreme emergence, the last revelation, is the greatest of all. And spirit is the Purusha, the all-person, the omnipresent conscious being. It is the mind's ignorance of this true person in us, its confusion of person with our experience of ego and limited personality, the misleading phenomenon of the emergence of limited consciousness and personality in an inconscient existence that have made us create an opposition between these two aspects of the reality. But in truth, there is no opposition. An eternal, infinite self-existence is the supreme reality. But the supreme transcendent eternal being, self and spirit, an infinite person, we may say, because his being is the essence and source of all personality, is the reality and meaning of self-existence. So too, the cosmic self, spirit, being, person, is the reality and meaning of cosmic existence. The same self, spirit, being, or person, manifesting its multiplicity, is the reality and meaning of the individual existence. So Satchit-Ananda is a person who establishes itself as the real center of all phases and stations of being. As the Lord and Master, it has gone forth into this world, as the Isha Upanishad says, and all of it is his habitation, dwells inside. In you is a universe, moving in a larger universe. It is a transcendent reality, beyond what it pours out in its scope as universe and individual, remains transcendent, and yet really is this cosmos, all this world, and what seems to be the small world in us, which is really always at one with the larger. And if we emerge our being by exceeding ego into the universality of this cosmos, we can then recognize it as an extension, a radiant extension of the being of that transcendence, and all become united in our consciousness of it. In the individual, aware of the universal, aware of the transcendence, there is the perfect harmony of all these states of being. All three poises become awake and aware at all stations at once. I think we've come to a good stopping point here, and we'll let that description of Satchitananda pouring itself out remain with us for a week, and we'll turn to a reading from Savitri tonight, drawn from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. In moments when the inner lamps are lit and the life's cherished guests are left outside, our spirit sits alone and speaks to its gulfs. A wider consciousness opens then its doors. Invading from spiritual silences, a ray of the timeless glory stoops a while to commune with our seized illumined clay and leaves its huge white stamp upon our lives. In the oblivious field of mortal mind, revealed to the closed prophet eyes of trance, or in some deep internal solitude, witnessed by a strange immaterial sense, the signals of eternity appear. The truth mind could not know unveils its face. We hear what mortal ears have never heard. We feel what earthly sense has never felt. We love what common hearts repel and dread. Our minds hush to a bright omniscient. A voice calls from the chambers of the soul. We meet the ecstasy of the Godhead's touch in golden privacies of immortal fire. These signs are native to a larger self that lives within us by ourselves unseen. Only sometimes a holier influence comes. A tide of mightier surgings bears our lives, and a diviner presence moves the soul. Or through the earthly coverings something breaks, a grace and beauty of spiritual light, the murmuring tongue of a celestial fire. Ourself and a high stranger whom we feel it is, and acts unseen as if it were not. It follows the line of sempiternal birth, yet seems to perish with its mortal frame. Assured of the apocalypse to be, it reckons not the moments and the hours. Great, patient, calm, it sees the centuries pass, awaiting the slow miracle of our change in the sure, deliberate process of world force and the long march of all revealing time. It is the origin and the master clue, a silence overhead, an inner voice, a living image seated in the heart, an unwalled wideness and a fathomless point, the truth of all these cryptic shows in space, the real towards which our strivings move, the secret grandiose meaning of our lives. A treasure of honey in the combs of God, a splendor burning in a tenebrous cloak. It is our glory of the flame of God, our golden fountain of the world's delight, an immortality cowled in the cape of death, the shape of our unborn divinity. It guards for us our fate in depths within, where sleeps the eternal seed of transient things. Always we bear in us a magic key, concealed in life's hermetic envelope, a burning witness in the sanctuary, regards through time and the blind walls of form. A timeless light is in his hidden eyes. He sees the secret things no words can speak, and knows the goal of the unconscious world, and the heart of the mystery of the journeying years. Jai Ma, Namaste.